Welcome to a new episode of Mystic Skeptic Radio's Uncensored. Today we have a special guest. Her name is Megan Allen. She's doing her master's at this time, and she can tell us a little bit about her background. But the topic is her thesis, which is called Transforming Expectations, Analyzing Mexican American Women's Connections to Culture as Transferred by Maternal Figures. Megan and I were talking before the show about how I went to an artist retreat, and instead of talking of a father's wound or having daddy issues, a lot of the artists were talking about how their relationships with their mothers were very dicey. And I had a different situation when my mom was younger, but now that she's older, it has become a little difficult. So we discuss different things that happen in relation to a cultural background as Mexican Americans or me being a first generation immigrant from Mexico. So if you can tell us about your school, your interest in this project, and how is it tied into the different books from, would you call them Chicano literary figures, or are they going by Mexican American at this time? It's depending on what writer we're talking about.
Yes, thank you so much. So it does typically depend on what the writer prefers as their label to identify them. The literary study is referred to as Chicano slash literary studies, and it's grounded in primarily theorists such as Gloria Anzaldúa, and Shetty Moraga, but it also takes from other literary figures such as Audre Lorde, Judith Butler, Adrienne Rich. There's various, it takes a lot of other figures. So that's the nice thing about Chicano literature is that, or excuse me, Chicano literary studies is that it pulls from a bunch of different areas of literary studies, combining a lot of the theory about that identity marginalization and the history of what that means to identity in America. But a little bit about myself. Yes, thank you. My name's Megan, and I'm currently about to be receiving my master's degree in English with the focus on Chicano studies. And I wrote my thesis on maternal transference of culture and how those cultural expectations, such as the gender roles, and the cultural roles for the women, typically determine how that culture gets transferred either positively or negatively. And then a little bit about my background is I have was born and raised in Houston, Texas. My mother is a Mexican woman. She is a second generation Mexican American. And my great great grandparents immigrated from Mexico to Texas. And a lot of my culture as a Mexican American woman was not transferred to me through my mother because, in my theory, she has negative experiences with it through her own gender expectations from the culture or the patriarchal expectations for women in the culture. So I'm looking to refine my way back to the culture while appreciating the indigenous roots and acknowledging my mother's experience as a woman in Mexican American culture as it translates to intergenerational trauma, which of course would be passed down the line to me as her daughter. So that's what really led me to this project was it was truly actually Shetty Moraga's memoir titled Native Country of the Heart, where which I believe she published in 2019. And she published it to create a testimonial for her mother's experience along with her own. And it creates this collective dynamic text that speaks to the multifaceted experience of being a Mexican American as it is a new contemporary experience with the changing social ideologies.
Well, for those who are not familiar with Chicano studies, I can tell you that I joined a group on Facebook and I told them, "Can you explain to me what even what a Chicano is?" Because coming from Mexico, a lot of these terms we haven't been exposed to them, and we have our own alienation for not being up to par with what's been going on with the immigrants or even the native Texans and Americans who were here and got wrapped up in the colonies and in the new country. So, people have paranoia about immigrants, especially if they don't look European. When I think I've had people tell me, the border crossed us because they were here originally, or they were part of the colonial folks that were here before the U.S. became I guess you call it a European country. They came from Spain or something else. So, and then the aspect of generational trauma and assimilation is interesting to me because one thing that I experienced coming from Mexico was that there was a lot of negative cultural things that I wanted to dispose of. And I felt maybe similar to your ancestors that somehow American culture, either because of its values or because of its freedom to kind of put away your individual cultural components, that you can be part of a bigger culture that supposedly sees you as part of the melting pot, but if you look different, you will always be the other.
Yes. So exactly as you just said, assimilation in Chicano studies, which I will work to define in just a moment, is they refer to it as a trap. They refer to it as a trap of assimilation because, as you said, there's always, if you're not white and male in this Anglocentric patriarchal society of America, then you are going to be marginalized in some way, whether that's as a woman, whether that's as a Mexican individual, a black person, or and even you could get into sexuality. You can be marginalized by your sexuality. So the Anglocentric ideology of America, as it was transferred from Europe back in the history when the Europeans came over to America and conquered it, and then yes, as you said too, the border crossed us. Texas was, in a lot of Chicano people's opinions, or not Chicano people's, but there is opinions that Texas is stolen land, and that it is not land that was politically or ethically gained by America. And so overnight, Mexicans living in Texas became Americans, but they were still Mexican, but they had to be American. So it's this conflict, as in it's an internal conflict with, you're in a country that expects you to be a certain way. It expects you to speak English. Oh, you're in America, you need to be speaking English. Whenever they're asking you to, they want you to assimilate, but they won't give you complete access to everything that, if you were to fully assimilate, you would think you would acquire, because they still, it's about the ideological viewpoint of seeing those differences, noticing those differences, and acknowledging them as different, as not normal or as not perfect, as not admirable. And so I think that a lot of that has to go into my mother's trauma with it, is that she most likely, and there's a lot that am still in the dark about with my mother. She hasn't shared a lot, but I get snippets time from time, and I can see the, reflection of the trauma that she's been through and how it is now imprinted onto herself as an individual, and how it carried her mindset through the years. And so it really becomes this problem of trying to figure out where you, quote unquote, belong. Because two, it's if you try to assimilate an American culture, you're probably going to still be seen as an outsider. But even if you try to go back to your Mexican roots, you can still be, seen as not being Mexican enough. You live in America, you have these Americanized views of things, so therefore you're no longer Mexican enough. So if you can't be American and you can't be Mexican, then what can you be? And that's really where that Chicano label comes into play. So the term Hispanic is another widely used term to describe Mexican American populations and communities, but it's a politicized term that was created in order to track the amount of Mexican Americans in America as they were coming in during, I believe it was the 60s and 70s, during the census. So this whole new, term Hispanic was created to account for them, and it's referred to by the Chicano theorist as that colonizer term. Now, it is in the efforts of being reclaimed, such as many other colonizer terms that you can see across other cultures. There's many terms that were used as derogatory or slanderous terms to designate a specific group that are now being reclaimed by that group and saying, this is who we are, and we are proud to be this. It's no longer something that you can refer to and be negative. It's something that I have pride in, and it's something that means something to me. And so that Chicano term is to, it's kind of, again, it's like a counterculture political term that is, it's, you are a second generation, you're a second or an other generation that has, was born, you're born in America, you have Mexican descent, but you also have that internalized knowledge of that idea, like I was saying, that you don't fit in either places. So you create a new space for yourself, a space where you exist within the borders of Mexico and America. And it is a powerful thing to be able to claim that identity and say with pride, I am a Chicano, instead of following with the Anglocentric term of Hispanic, which, and many people don't even realize that that term was created to, account for the influx of Mexican Americans coming into America. While some people may not take offense to it, there are others. I speak again of Sheri Moraga. She actually came to my university, Sam Houston State University, and she spoke, and she was very adamant about not being called Hispanic. She was not Hispanic. She was a Chicana, and that's what she wanted to be. And it's about aligning yourself with that movement, acknowledging the history of what America or what, European history has done to these marginalized ethnic groups, and collectively coming together to be this power to fight against it. So that's what I really, relate my, that's what I really find inspiration in, is I've come to learn all of these theories and all of these ideas about what it means to be a Chicana. And I too feel that questioning, where do I fit in? Because I, reading Moraga's Native Country of the Heart, truly made me realize that I am Chicana. I do have Mexican descent. My mother is Mexican. And as much as maybe she had tried to get me to erase it, and I don't even want to say that she wanted me to erase it, but I would say that she was okay with letting it go. And I think that that was because she saw America, or being American, as being better than being considered Mexican. But I don't see it that way, or more so that I see my Mexican identity as being just as important as the American side of my identity as well. Whereas it was not transferred to me from my maternal lineage, or at least from my direct maternal lineage. My grandmother still very much has that cultural aspect of her life, but it is not something that I have really taken the time to record properly. I do have cousins, which is something else that helped me realize the importance of this argument, is that I have cousins similar in age or very close in age who have shared experiences, not quite knowing where they fit along the spectrum, struggling with their mothers and understanding why their mothers taught them to be certain ways as women, and understanding that they were taught to be women a certain way by their mother. You know, it's this huge maternal transmission of culture through generations that has brought myself, my cousins, and other Chicanas to where we are now, in the moment of time where we've come to realize that we have to acknowledge this past to be able to seek out a more diverse and represented future.
I want to talk about different terms that I've come across and how I view them. In Texas, and I guess the only other place I lived is Tennessee, I've heard the term Mexican being used as a derogatory term in the way that people say it. And maybe I'm paranoid, but being from Mexico, it's just funny that sometimes people would like bring it up out of the blue, like it's there's a thing about how do I you identify yourself, and a thing about how people see you. So at one point, I realized that some people make a big deal about where you're from, and I was trying to get away from that because I didn't want to be put on the spot. And I know for Mexican folks that might be a cowardly thing to do to not be proud of being Mexican or wear it in your lapel or whatever, but so that was one element. And then when the term Latinx came around, it felt like it was imposed by certain elements of the Latino community that felt disenfranchised. And again, if we're gonna go by how you define yourself, if it doesn't speak to you, if it's not something that you feel connected to, I would take the approach that if they want to call themselves Latinx, that's great. I have no problem with Latino or Latin or something like that. To me, it's always been weird because, other than the Spanish language coming from Latin, it doesn't make any sense. I would actually prefer Latin American, as acknowledging that all Spanish speaking and Portuguese speaking countries are part of the Americas. But regarding this aspect of also of the patriarchy, I hold like a moderate view about, we have to be honest about how, because of whatever was going on in history, it was usually the men that were in leadership. But there are some cultures where the women are in leadership, and both men and women can be horrible. So my caveat for the patriarchy would be like, is it a toxic patriarchy that demeans women and people who are not like them? Or is it a just happened to be or an ongoing leadership that was taken by the men for religious or cultural reasons as compared to a destructive force as a patriarchy? Because we're assuming that all patriarchies are evil if we focus on them in a certain way. And I've actually been part of a very toxic matriarchy in my family, where the men were kind of pushovers and the women were causing a lot of harm and conflict. So I don't know if you have run into that in your studies of the Latinos, and not just in the US, but also in our home countries.
I do think I do think that you made a good point about the fact that we're, you know, you shouldn't assume that all patriarchies are toxic. I think that coming from a woman's perspective, it, you know, because I forgot to add in, It's not just Chicana theory that I look at, it's Chicana feminist theory that I look at. So as a woman, my perspective is a little bit biased, I feel, because of my gender identification. But a lot of the history of that, the gender expectation too, that has been implicated onto not just women, but men as well, again, stems from like we were saying, that history of, yes, it wasn't just the men who are in the ones who were, in political roles and battle and, making the financial decisions. It was the fact that religious doctrine also pushed the idea of men being the superior, figure in that gender dynamic. Now, as that translated into the Mexican culture, there are plenty of matriarchal, matrilineal, indigenous tribes and ethnic groups that exist, and there are plenty of matriarchal figures in the Mexican American or even indigenous Latinx cultures that you can see. So the one that I focused on was La Malinche. And she is often regarded as the mother of all mestizos. And mestizo, if I'm remembering correctly, is a label to designate, the like community or the group of indigenous, South American, Mexican, tribes with the European, Spanish, party. I apologize for not having a better definition. But yeah, so La Malinche is often regarded as the mother of all mestizos, and she was Hernan Cortez's concubine. So she was his right-hand woman, for lack of a better word. But a lot of what my research looks at is that she was a victim herself. She was sold into slavery, most likely to pay off, some sort of agreement within her family. She was sold as a lot of times women were sold because they were sold for their sexual subservience. And so she was sold into slavery, and Cortez took her on as his concubine as he was, ravaging across Mexico, for the Spanish. And she was versed in Nahua, the Nahua language that the indigenous tribes spoke, and she served as translator for him. She also birthed one of his sons. But a lot of people see her as a traitor. So they see her as this figure that this woman who betrayed her people. And so her as a figure also stands in comparison to another very important figure of a maternal figure of Mexican American culture, which is the Virgin of Mary. And so it's this dichotomy between Malinche, who a lot of Mexican Americans would look at as a traitor and a whore and, someone that you don't want to be, or you're a virginal, chaste, subservient and dutiful wife. So it created this very hard image for women to be. They were either one of those two things. If they weren't one, they were the other. And so it was very hard, again, to find that balance between wanting to be a dutiful wife and uphold the expectations, of the culture for the men, which, relates to, again, that patriarchal vision. And then, of course, as history just went on, that just became ingrained in the culture. And then when you compared it to American culture too, that became more of like that promised land. You could see how women in the 60s or the 70s in America were getting a lot more freedoms, and they were able to do more and have more and it in comparison to the experiences of Mexican women seemed glamorous and desirable, even though there are still patriarchal and sexist expectations for women in America as well. As far as on the spectrum of those expectations go, American women had, they did have more freedoms than the Mexican women. So it really was, it, those two figures, again, returning back to those two figures of La Malinche and the Virgin Mary, or, you know, the Virgin de Guadalupe, they are these two embodiments of Mexican American feminine standards that have perpetuated that idea of what a woman should be. And, you know, not just for women, but for men as well. You know, it's not like women are the only ones who know these stories. Men know these stories as well. So that's another element of that perpetuation. And I think that it's just this drastic change that has, that we've seen over, you know, a short span of time, or at least over time, change is happening faster. I guess, I suppose that's a better way to say it. And it's becoming a changing dynamic to where it feels like we might be losing the culture by also losing those gender expectations. But I don't feel that, I feel that culture does transform. And that's another part of what being a Chicana means, is that transformation is going to happen. And it's about understanding the elements that brought you to where you are now, and understanding the elements that continue to affect the future implications of this identity, you know, of these identity roles.
Have you had a chance to see the movie from Scorsese, Children of the Flower Moon?
I have not had a chance to see that one yet. What's it about?
So I don't know what state or city it is, but it's somewhere in the frontier. And there was a tribe that had an area, and they found oil. So the government or some company bought it from them, and they all received a pension. And it shows Native Americans being wealthy and having white chauffeurs and white servants. And then some fell in love and married some of the settlers, or I guess European Americans. And then one of the scam artists that lived around, he started poisoning them. So he could, through different means, try to get those rights to him and his family. And I've only watched like 40 minutes of it, and it makes you angry. Like, it's hard to believe that a thing is based on a true story, that people can be that evil. And it's interesting, as I reflect on it, is that in American society, if you're not wealthy, you're not successful. So the only reason this movie was made is because it shows you Native Americans as successful entrepreneurs and wealthy. If they were poor, nobody would care. So the element of having limited means is something that affects Latinos back in the day and now. And I guess some of them, if they were ranchers or they joined the military or had a company or something like that, maybe they became wealthy. But does that ever come into the fore when you deal with these memoirs, that having limited resources, you can have freedom, you can have maybe some type of equality, being able to vote and have more access to things as a woman with a Latino background, but poverty and the lack of generational wealth, how does that play in the Chicano identity?
Oh, it absolutely plays a very critical element, because again, you look back to the financial relationship, or excuse me, the economic relationship between Mexico and America, as being this charged idea that has driven a lot of immigration, not just from, Mexicans from Mexico, but from many marginalized groups into America, because America does have it is an economic powerhouse. It does provide opportunities for people. However, can they pull themselves up by their bootstraps and make it in the world like they try to make it out to be? In my opinion, no. I think that that's a false narrative, because I think that there's always going to be a way to keep marginalized groups down. And that also determines that, or doesn't determine, but that also factors into why people leave their cultural identity behind, is because they want to build, that better future or that generational wealth, whatever that may look like for them. But a part of that includes letting go of a piece of their identity that America doesn't want. Because again, like I said, the Anglocentric, hegemonic idea of people who can succeed is typically limited to white men. And it becomes this, it definitely, the resource limitation plays into that identification, because you can be laughed at or marginalized because of your class status. You can have less resources in schools. If you're in a lower income school district, you're going to have less resources to learn about these ideas. You're going to have less of a, impact from the community around you, because everyone else in that community too is they it's I'm trying to think about how I want to describe it. It's almost like it's institutionalized. That's what it is. It's institutionalized racism or marginalization, if that's whichever you prefer. But it's I don't want to keep saying perpetuation, but it's, there are so many institutions that when you identify as Mexican American or as Mexican, as we had said previously, you're seen as less than. Even if they may not realize that they're doing it, people see Mexicans a certain way. And that comes along with many other stigmas and stereotypes that are negative and demoralizing to the identity and the possibilities that they're just leaving behind, that they're, excuse me, the possibilities that they're not seeing the potential. And like, I'm not trying to be, like, I feel like I'm trying to put myself on a pillar here, and I'm trying to avoid that. But, if you always regard a marginalized group in a certain way, you're always going to have that confirmation bias. You're going to keep looking for things that confirm your stereotypical bias against this community. But if you see them in diverse representations, such as myself too, I'm Chicana, I'm Mexican American, and my mother, she likes to view, or she I shouldn't say she likes to view, she does view Mexicans as, lazy and a drain on the system, and all the other negative stereotypes that you hear about Mexicans. That's what she thinks. And it's so frustrating, because at the same time, she's completely negating that that is who I am too. And I guess to return to that idea of the resource limitations, I was very fortunate. My mother didn't want me to know my Mexican identity or to celebrate my Mexican culture. But I found my way back to it because I wanted to. And I found relatability through Shuri Moraga's Native Country of the Heart. So I saw the representation of myself in a text that is phenomenal. It is a phenomenal text that stretches back to through her own mother's story. And it just was this beautiful connection that I felt where I felt like I belonged for the first time. And I would not have known that if I did not have the access to go to school, to go to university, and to get my exposure to the Chicano studies. So I absolutely consider myself very fortunate, which is why I want to advocate for that positive view and that, support of Chicana, future Chicana, Chicanos, Mexican American, Latinx populations, because they deserve to know and appreciate and acknowledge that they matter. Their identity matters. Their history matters. America did not wipe that out. We are here, and it's important to know that. It's important to teach that, because that's what they want, is they want you to forget. And I say they, I mean the institutionalized hegemonic Anglocentric powers, the powers that be, the powers that want the white people to stay in charge, to stay the ones in power, to stay the ones making the laws. They want to keep people divided and not realizing the opportunities, the options, the potential information and knowledge that is out there for them to take in and to put back out into the world and strengthen that collective identity of what it means to be Chicana.
Let's talk about the self-hatred that you mentioned. I know that it's easy to divide and conquer Latinos because, like Donald Trump did in the 2016 run for office, he said, they're sending us the worst from Mexico. And all my friends said, they're not talking about us. He's talking about those riffraffs that don't know how to behave. So very easily, he was able to split. The well-behaved, almost Barack Obama used to talk about within the black community, you have the respectability factor where you have to behave, you have to almost what some people call act white to be taken seriously. And if you're anything other than that, you're not welcome or you're not part of the conversation. And I know a lot of people who, when they marry white, then suddenly all their identity can, they think they can put it under the rug and they can behave differently, especially the women when they take the last name or when their babies look different than the rest of their families. So this self-hatred a lot of times is comes even from the Spaniards where they would put down people so much that they'll start believing the stereotypes and they start putting themselves and their families down and becoming subservient. So, at the other side of the break, if you can tell us from your research, how does that play a role in the Chicano experience? And how are you able to challenge your mom when she's being prejudicial towards her own people?
Sure, yeah, sounds good.
Welcome back. We are talking to Megan Allen about her thesis, Transforming Expectations, Analyzing Mexican American Women's Connections to Culture as Transferred by Maternal Figures, here on Mystic Skeptic Radio's Uncensored. And we were discussing how the Latino community can be very harsh with itself. As individuals, we can look down on people that we think are not living up to their best selves and they're making us look bad, or we can just have an internalized self-hatred based on the conquest from the Spaniards or being always subservient, even in America. And I experience full racism, and the way that I describe racism for people who maybe are not familiar with it is people expecting or thinking the worst of you, and having that confirmation bias where, if you mess up or you always have to prove yourself to them. Until I lived in Tennessee, and it was because I was the only Mexican in the whole county, and the only Mexicans that people had ever run into are people that work in Mexican restaurants. So automatically they're very, they're serving you. So I was trying to organize some people within a community, and I started having people tell me what to do and boss me around. And I, it was strange, coming from Mexico, and even in Texas, that I had never experienced that. So it's just interesting that I guess my white privilege was challenged being thrown in with all the other Latinos. Being light skinned in Mexico gives you some privileges or some, assumptions. As an immigrant, you become part of the people in the same boat, and especially if you are not wealthy, you have double trouble, and you'll never be seen as an equal, no matter how educated and how eloquent or how much English you know. So I was asking Ms. Allen, how does that play a role in the Chicano studies that she has researched?
Yeah, so I actually wanted to make a quick comment. You mentioned something about just that self-hatred between the Latinx or the Mexican community within themselves. So in one of my texts that I used in my thesis paper, it was Reina Grande's The Distance Between Us, and it's another memoir where the author Reina Grande, she recalls after they immigrated to America, after they crossed the border illegally when she was 10, and they received their green card several years later. I believe it was either during the 80s, during like the, I don't know if it was Reagan administration or one of the presidential administrations that, managed to get a lot of green cards passed. After the family received their green cards, Reina and her sister went back to Mexico, Iguala. Guerra, and actually in Mexico to be more specific. And she recalls visiting her childhood friends. And remember, she immigrated when she was 10. So she had most of her early childhood in Mexico, where she lived in poverty with her siblings without her parents, because her parents had already immigrated to America and left them in the care of their grandparents. But returning back to the point, when she came back to Mexico and had met with her close friends, they treated her differently. They treated her like she was American. They kind of tiptoed around her and didn't, talk to her the same way. And even she made the comment where they stated that her accent was different. And even though Reina herself couldn't recognize that change, the people in Mexico did, and she was seen as different than them, even though that was exactly where her childhood was. She lived on, the same street, went to the school for a certain amount of time with these friends. And that, conversely, one thing I love about that text, The Distance Between Us, is that you see not only Reina's perspective, but Reina's older sister, Mago, who, again, if we consider that gendered transmission of culture through the maternal line, we can see it down to Mago first and then down to Reina. And an interesting thing, sorry, I digress, because Mago becomes a maternal figure for Reina while their biological mother is in America. That's what I was trying to say. But Mago completely dissociates from her Mexican identity. And for her, Reina says that the trip is like a vacation. She doesn't want to be there. She talks about how dusty it is and how it's making her shoes dirty. And Reina is so confused at how her older sister could reject this homeland that they came from, that they all collectively experienced together. And that's where, again, my argument comes in, that negative trauma of living in poverty and being parentified at a young age for Mago completely causes her to dissociate from her Mexican identity and have that internalized self-hatred too against her Mexican identity, because nothing's going to change the fact that Mago came from Iguala, but she can do everything in her power to reject that identity and say, that's not me anymore. Just because I may have been born here doesn't mean that I associate myself with it anymore. And it's really an upsetting thing. But of course, it's understandable whenever you do understand intergenerational trauma and how it has the ability to fracture those identities that exist inside of a person. Returning to my own experience, I have a friend, actually, and she is Mexican American as well. Very similar situation where her mother is Mexican and her father is white, just like myself. And we shared our own collective, experiences as Chicana women. And but she is, her skin tone is pale, 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 pale. And I asked her one day as I was thinking about my thesis, I said, do people ever question if you're Mexican? And she was like, oh yeah, all the time. She was like, they never believe that I'm Mexican. Like, it's, I, and she, like you were saying, has to prove herself to be a Mexican. And it's like, and I always tell people, I'm like, she's more Mexican than me. Like, she actually knows more Spanish than I do. She actually cooks the foods from Mexico. And she, I just don't know how to explain it. She's just, she is more performatively Mexican than me, and a part of being, advocating for that Mexican identity and having that Mexican pride, in my opinion, is performing that identity and, supporting the artistic style. And, I just, I want to, I don't want people to have to. First of all, people shouldn't even question if someone says they're Mexican. Like, I, because that's, again, that's looking at that collective diverse representation. You can be Mexican and not be brown skinned. You can be all sorts of different skin tones and be Mexican or Chicano or Latinx. You can have blue eyes and be Mexican. It's not exclusive to a specific representational identity. And that's what's important, because if you think that, then again, you're always going to confirm that through your own biases. And it's just one of those things that really gets under my skin, because I don't think that people should have to prove who they are to anybody. I think that it's important to understand that diversity and where we are as a population today does not look the same as it did, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's completely different now. So you can't try and fit people into a box, because that's not how that works. And leading into that idea that you mentioned before the break about combating that kind of prejudicial viewpoint from my mother, it can be difficult. And if I'm being honest, it's very much so a still a work in progress. A lot of my thesis was therapeutic self-help work that allowed me to reestablish my own identity without my mother. And that was very hard. And that, because again, my mother is so important to that cultural transference, but in a way so that almost worked opposite. So she like didn't want me to be Mexican, and I rebelled against that. And so, not that I wanted to be Mexican just as a rebellious way, but I wanted to understand why my mom didn't appreciate her Mexican identity, except for the exoticism of her beauty, of her, you know, brown skin and her dark features. And she, tried to help me understand that in various ways, but it, as a child, there were specific instances that I can recall, one of which is very formative, and it's when I got teased in elementary school for having hairy arms, because that is obviously coming from my Mexican American lineage, or my Mexican lineage, excuse me. And instead of explaining that to me about, oh, well, or just explaining anything about why I was more hairy, why my eyebrows were larger, why my skin was a little darker, why my hair was so freaking curly and not straight like all my friends. But none of that was explained. It was just kind of brushed aside, and I had to internalize a lot of those negative feelings without having someone there to explain them to me until, again, I got to be where I am now and have created an identity for myself that did not agree with my mother's expectation of what she wanted me to be. As I age, of course, every, adolescent ages to a point where they start wanting to create their own identity. And a lot of times that can go against what your parents expect of you, what your parents thought you were going to turn out to be. And I still want to have this relationship with my mother, but she can be very prejudicial and, homophobic and transphobic and just very heavily conservative. And not just, I don't, I respect her conservative views. She can hold them all she wants, but it's when she starts to express to me whenever she knows that they're not my viewpoints. And it can be difficult to combat them because she is my mother. And there is, again, that expectation of, you should respect your elders. She's your mother. You should, not yell at her and respect what she has to say. But how am I respecting myself by ignoring the discomfort that I feel when she says things that I disagree with? And so I wouldn't like combating them is more of a strategic game of chess for me and my mother. I want to have a relationship with her, and I've taken a lot of time in personal therapy. I've done a lot of research, and I've done a lot of self-reflecting to say that I do want this relationship with my mother. But at the same time, if she is going to continue to ignore my identity and my identity as a Chicano woman, and she, again, she may not realize that she's doing it, but every time she speaks negatively against any marginalized groups, I feel hurt because Chicana feminism seeks to align not just the collective experience of Mexican Americans, but the collective experience of anyone living in the borderlands of identity. That includes race, ethnicity, class, religion, sex, gender, all of these different elements that go into your identity. You don't, you, they, you can be within the border of certain things, and you don't have to exist in just one static version of yourself, like that box I was referring to. There is no box. My identity is kaleidoscopic and multifaceted. And when my mother rejects one piece of it, in my mind, she rejects all of it. And that hurts. And it can be difficult, again, to say the least. It's very difficult. I really want her to, she has not read my thesis. I want her to read my thesis. I'm not quite sure if she'd understand the implication that I was seeking, with my research behind it, as it's based in her. But I think it will at least open the door for conversations. And I think that is the most important thing, is having that communication and those conversations. And that's why when my mom does say things that I may not agree with, sometimes it can be hard and I do want to just walk away. But other times I stand my ground and I at least tell her, first of all, I don't like the way you're saying that, or I don't, appreciate you speaking like that about, my friend, or, like, why would you say something like that? I try to get her to understand that's not okay with me. And I want to say that there is baby steps of progress happening. I mean, it's very complicated. But I like to look more towards the future and less at the past. And I am very happy with the fact that my sister, my older sister, has, my niece, and I like to see how my sister has come to parent her daughter, as a reflection of, or, of her experiences with my mother, but wanting that better experience, but and not putting Zoe, my niece, excuse me, in a box. And it's something that I hope to discuss with my mom in greater detail later. I just, in all honesty, don't feel that I have the words to properly describe it to her at this time. It's only a very new revelation to me, and that mother wound is something that really can stretch back through time, because I also recognize that she has a mother wound as well. And that's allowed me to really empathize and sympathize with who she is as a person and how she goes about living her everyday life. So it's given me a lot of perspective, this project, working on this paper, doing this research. And I'm really very fortunate to have had this experience, to be exposed to this knowledge. And I just want to do my part and be able to put that knowledge back out into the world in any way that I can.
Before we run out of time in our radio version, we can stick around for a few more minutes and people can catch us on the podcast or YouTube. But Miss Allen, tell us about the two other authors that you mentioned in your book, and then I'll have a final thought after we finish the hour here on Radio Free Nashville.
Sure, yeah. So my thesis focused on three texts. So my first chapter was about cultural transference, and it was focusing on Raina Grande's text, The Distance Between Us. And that is the memoir that focuses on Raina Grande and her siblings, Mago and Carlos, as they experience the trauma of living in the borderlands and what that means as they age into adulthood. The second text that I use is Erica Sanchez's young adult fiction novel, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. This is a great text that has been receiving wide acclaim recently, especially when it comes to young adults. And it has also recently been placed on certain book bans in some counties, which obviously book bans are another discussion altogether. But it is a great text that focuses on Julia, a young teen who is learning where she fits into society, because she is a 100% Mexican, descendant. Both her parents are Mexican. She lives in Chicago, though, so she is a first generation Mexican American, and she has to come to learn the past that her mother and her sister have dealt with as women, as Mexican women, and the cultural and gender expectations. Then the final text, as I've mentioned several times previously, is Shadi Moraga's Native Country of the Heart. This is the text that inspired me to write my thesis. Moraga is a beautiful writer, as she memoirs not just her own experience, but her mother, Elvira Moraga's experience. And later in the text, Elvira starts to suffer from Alzheimer's, and this loss of her cognitive memory is transmitted into a body memory that you can see Moraga focuses on throughout the text. So the third chapter really focuses on the embodied cognition of those lived experiences as they've transferred down through intergenerational lines. Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. And like I shared with you guys previously, this concludes our radio version. If you'd like to hear the ongoing conversation, you can catch us on Raiders of the Unknown podcast, which where we have both the Uncensored and Raiders of the Unknown from Mystic and the Skeptic. And then we'll try to put it on our Uncensored YouTube channel as well. Ms. Allen, two things that I wanted to bring up in relation to what you were sh saying. I don't want to conduct an intercession or what is it called? When you pull someone aside and you have an intervention regarding your relationship with your mom. But there's something that came to the forefront in my work with this victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. I don't know if you're familiar with the new TV show on Netflix called Little Reindeer.
I have seen of it. I have not watched it yet.
Okay, so in that show, it addresses how a perpetrator of abuse has so much power over an individual, and the reason that they have power is because they tap into a need or a lack of attention or support that you're not receiving from healthy sources, so you keep going back to that unhealthy and destructive force because they give you something that you would usually get from a better source, but they're the only ones that are providing it, and it almost becomes like an addiction. I don't want to make any claims about understanding you and your mother's relationship, but the one thing that I've seen in my own personal life is that when someone's opinion takes over, and their opinion and their views not only hurt you, but they become like part of you, and you judge yourself, or you always, you kind of hesitate in your own thinking because you wonder what they think and how are they gonna react to something. It's a very common pattern. So I'm sure your mom is a lovely lady and she's just, has her ways, but have you considered that some of the things that she does that are hurtful are part of that abusive emotionally and sometimes even spiritually abusive patterns that people fall into where they know how to hurt you where it affects you the most, and they manipulate you to always have them in your mind and kind of have to live up to their expectations as much as you don't appreciate their expectations, that their thinking and their ways are always with you. So it's an ongoing burden that you carry.
Absolutely. It is absolutely, you're absolutely right about that. She, first of all, I will say, she is a lovely woman. she's not the worst person in the world. She is a product of the world around her and her interactions and her experiences. And that's where I guess I shouldn't intellectualize it though. Because at the end of the day, you're right. She can be mean. She does know how to hurt me, and she does hurt me when she wants to. And while our relationship hasn't been like that in a while, there were various other factors and within my family dynamic that were stressors in everyone's life in our family. Doesn't make give her an excuse to be mean because I never sunk to that level, and that's one thing I never wanted to do. And You actually bring up, a really good point, because one thing, again, like I said, it's an ongoing battle. I've done a lot of therapy, and recently, as my graduation is coming closer, one of the regalia items that I could choose to wear as I crossed the stage included a cultural stole. So they had a sarape, the Mexican cultural stole that they offered for students to purchase. And I wanted it. I wanted to buy it, but I still have that internalized struggle of wondering what my mom would have thought. Because again, my mom, I don't think my mom fully realizes, that I identify as Chicana and that I'm learning to celebrate my Mexican culture and I'm trying to find my way back through that intergenerational traumatic lineage, of maternal trauma to heal. And I wanted that serape, but I didn't buy it at first. But then my therapist convinced me. She was like, "Why did you not want to buy it again?" And I told her, I was like, "Well, I was wondering what my mom would have thought." And exactly like you said, I was concerned about what somebody else would have thought whenever I know I'm Chicana. I am Chicana. I need to celebrate that. And I need to not be so concerned with what my mom thinks of me. It's just, I don't like making excuses. It's just, it's a battle between the brain and the heart. It really is, and like you said, that spiritual connection too, because I feel a spiritual connection to my mother as the woman, who brought me into this world, as the woman who taught me to be a woman. Again, that connection that a woman has with her mother is crucial. And yes, there are plenty of women who do grow up without their biological maternal figure, but somebody becomes that maternal figure and teaches or, represents what a woman is. And that was my mother for me. And yes, as I grew to learn that her representation was one of the many and not even necessarily the most healthy representation, it was mine. And it was very hard to accept that. It still is very hard to acknowledge and understand that my mom has a certain expectation of me that I don't want to fill. And while she's starting to understand that, I don't know if at some point in the future there might end up becoming another thing that she doesn't like. And we end up going no contact because I'm not going to appease to her views and, lifestyle choices over my own, because that's looking at her happiness over my own just because I want my mother in my life. And yeah, that's important. Yeah, I want my mother in my life. I think a lot of people typically want their mother to be the person that they want them to be. And sometimes they're not. And that's okay, but you need to learn to respect yourself, respect them. And if that relationship works, then fantastic. But if the figure that you're trying to work with continues to cross boundaries and disrespect and not value you for who you are, then, at what point, whose peace are you really saving by keeping yourself quiet? So I did buy the serape. I am going to wear it across the stage, and I'm going to feel so proud to represent as a Mexican American Chicana woman. And if my mom says anything about it, then that's a bridge I'll cross when I get there. But I'm not concerned. If she says something, then she says something. I don't care. I'm learning that I need to believe in myself and not care about what she thinks, because this isn't her life, it's my life.
Thank you for that. And finally, it's just I'm the biggest critic of the Latino community when it comes down to lack of sophistication or interest in bettering themselves. And it's a few people that we even have access to that been able to overcome that or reclaim some of the Latino things and brought them to a higher level. So the do you run into this idea where people are almost like nativist Latinos where they think that if it's Mexican is better than if it's European or something like that, and they like to keep things in a very like rustic perspective? Because one of my favorite movies is the Frida Kahlo movie, even though I like the original one in Mexico better than the Salma Hayek one, because it shows how cosmopolitan Mexico City was in the 1930s, and that it was a hodgepodge of people from all over the world, as compared to the way we're depicted in Coco and other silly, almost like pandering movies where we're all ignorant, we're all living in dirt roads, we're all very simple people. And then that perpetuates a stereotype. And then some people like the stereotype, or they think that that's what truly means to be Mexican, is to keep everything very unsophisticated. So when and even in my family, they discourage me from pursuing higher education and just work. As and I can see that with is the opposite of other immigrant communities. Have you run into that where, like, you're not a real Mexican if you don't stick to Mexican popular culture, which a lot of it is as terrible as American popular culture, and anybody who's into literature, art, culture, you're almost like a house slave or a European wannabe, which to me sounds ridiculous. They've never heard of Benito Juárez, who knew Latin and was the first indigenous president in Latin America. But back then, he had to assimilate and become almost like indigenous people in Canada, where they become French by denying their identity. And that's what some of us have had to do, or think that that's the right way to go, and not being judged or being put down for doing things that take get us to a different place in our life.
Yeah, so while I haven't personally encountered someone who, I wasn't discouraged from seeking out higher education. I was encouraged, even though I am a first generation graduate. Neither of my parents did graduate from college. And I mean, they're successful in their own way now. But it was instilled in me to go to college, but without the like value of what college could do to me. It was more of just like that Americanized ideal of you're going to grow up, you're going to go to college, and you're going to get a job, and everything's going to be great. I think that was really what my parents tended to push on me. But in my text, in the text that I analyze, I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, there is a very similar kind of scenario where the main character, Julia, she has a lot of that self-hatred that we were discussing, and it almost seems like she glamorizes American culture a little bit, higher than her Mexican culture. She likes going to the art museum and reading Walt Whitman, and she doesn't like listening to like corridos, like her friend Lorena does. And she doesn't believe in, the Catholic ideologies and stuff like that. So she definitely is like counter Mexican cultural representation, but she is still Mexican representation. And I think that for me, I wouldn't discredit the indigenous or nativist way of living, as long as they wouldn't discourage my contemporary modern way of living. Because I do have friends who still have family in Mexico, and they go down there and they stay on a ranch. They don't stay in a hotel. They don't, stay in a house in the middle of the city. They stay on a ranch and they've got goats and chickens and, they live off the land. And it's part of what they love, and it's who they are. And I love that for them. That may not be my ideal living situation, but it's who they are. It's what they like, as long as they don't discourage or discredit others from wanting more for themselves. If they do want more for themselves, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're trying to completely reject their Mexican identity. It just means that they are, it's just that transformation. Culture is going to transform. We can't even say that the culture that, the culture that we have now, whether it's, Chicana culture, Latinx culture, Black culture, all of these different cultures have transformed over time. None of them are exactly as they were when they were originally established. So that transformation is going to happen. And the longer that I feel people, want to stereotype or keep people in boxes, it's going to prevent them from seeing that transformation. And then that's how people tend to start to lose that connection, because they aren't willing to transform. They aren't willing to take in new ideas. They aren't willing to understand new perspectives, because they just want things to stay the way that they were taught how things were supposed to be. But that's not how the world works. And I think that the sooner that people start to realize that, the better, because it's means that you aren't going, it means you can be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. Because if we don't transform, we're going to get stuck in the past. So I think that it is important to transform while also still maintaining the value of that connection to history and understanding the importance of those figures and what they can represent to people. Jose Montoya, La Malinche, the Virgin de Guadalupe, Hernan Cortez, these people all represent different things for everyone in the culture. And that's okay. They don't have to fit into the box, just like you don't have to fit into the box, just like I don't have to fit into the box. There shouldn't be a box in the first place. The diverse representation of any marginalized community, of any ethnic community, any racial community is vast. You cannot try and stick people into one experience, into one living situation, into one educational bracket. Every, people grow, they interact, they conversate, and we share information. And especially with the expansion of internet and technology, information is zooming around the world. People are starting to learn things that, at the tip of their fingers. And that is creating a huge accessibility boom for people. Not for everyone, I will admit. But it's great to see that transformation. But some people are getting scared because it's happening very quickly and it's different.